Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello, it's Tuesday, the 27th of March, 2018. Welcome to Africa Link with me, Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. We are coming to you live from Bonn in Germany.
In today's edition, Angola issues fraud charges against son of former president. How significant is this in President João Lourenço's fight against corruption?
It plays well domestically, but it is also about showing that the Lourenço administration will clamp down on serious corruption.
And the Kenyan government blocks opposition politician Miguna Miguna from returning to Kenya and attempt to deport him back to Canada after a nine-hour standoff at a Nairobi airport.
They want to take me to Dubai, so I'm not going. I've refused to go. They say they now want to remove me by force. Well, they would have to kill me first.
Those stories and a lot more coming up shortly.
But first, let's hear what's been happening around the world.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Several Kenyan journalists resigned en masse on Tuesday, saying they were assaulted by police for covering the attempted deportation of opposition leader Miguna Miguna. The journalists reported they were kicked and punched by police officers during an hour-long standoff at Nairobi Airport late on Monday, when Miguna was seized and taken to an airport police station. His detention comes amid a security crackdown declared by President Uhuru Kenyatta following his re-election win. Opposition Senator James Orengo condemned Miguna's arrest and said he should have been given safe passage into the country.
The Kenyan authorities, what they should have done was to validate that passport which we had taken away from him and allow him back into the country in accordance with the court order.
An opposition party member has also been detained in Burundi, where party members have confirmed the arrest of politician Alois Barrichako, president of the National Gathering for Change party. Party members said Barrichako was arrested Monday evening after he attended a funeral in the central city of Gitega. The Central African nation has been rocked by insecurity since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza sought a third term in office. An NGO forum kicked off today in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, where 36 local and international nonprofits, including Oxfam and ActionAid, discussed the most pressing issues people have been facing around the world. Policy advisor of the Nigerian NGO forum, Raisin Mangin, spoke to DW about these challenges.
We have 1.6 million people who are displaced. We have over 3 million children out of school with no education. We have 3 million people who are going to be food insecure. So due to insecurity, we cannot access an estimated 930,000 people.
This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. Former Catalan President Carles Puigdemont has spoken for the first time after being detained in Germany, vowing to never surrender his fight for regional independence from Spain and saying that he has full trust in the German legal system. Puigdemont made his comments Tuesday while in German custody after he was arrested on a European warrant. His comments come amid major demonstrations in the Catalan region, where several pro-independence demonstrators have blocked motorways in protest of his detention and possible extradition to Spain on charges of rebellion. German police have arrested four people after discovering explosives and hazardous chemicals at a Bavarian homeless shelter. One person remains in custody and is due to appear in court over the alleged use of the materials, which have since been destroyed. German police are investigating whether the materials were part of an extremist plot. And now in sports, Bayern Munich goalkeeper Manuel Neuer celebrates his 32nd birthday today and has returned to training for the first time since September, when he suffered a hairline fracture in his left foot. The captain of the German national team said he hopes to return in time for the June World Cup games in Russia. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
You are listening to Africa Link Live. I'm Wanjiko Mwaura.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. If you are listening to us on Facebook, DW Africa, leave us your comments below on the post there. We will get to them when we can.
Yes, indeed. Now we move on to our top story, Africa, where the son of Angola's ex-president, José Eduardo dos Santos, has been formally accused of fraud. The charges against José Filomeno dos Santos relate to a $500 million transaction out of an account belonging to the central bank. Filomeno was appointed to head the $5 billion sovereign fund by his father in 2013, but then was sacked by President João Lourenço, who took power in January.
Now, the younger dos Santos, who has been barred from leaving the country, is the highest profile person targeted in new President Lourenço's anti-corruption drive. Does President Lourenço have enough support within the ruling elite, the Futungo, and among ordinary Angolans to go after the dos Santos family? A question I put to Alex Fiennes, head of the Africa program at the British think tank Chatham House.
Well, there is a strong and vibrant middle class in Angola, and this plays very well to them. So I do think he has some strength, and that's why I think he has moved on these corruption cases, such as on the President dos Santos' son Zenu, because it plays well domestically, but it is also about showing that the Lourenço administration will clamp down on serious corruption. And so that's what I think is occurring here. There is an impact on this, which is that the relationship between João Lourenço and the former president, José Eduardo dos Santos, has significantly deteriorated, and they don't talk to each other. Your listeners should bear in mind that José Eduardo dos Santos remains the president of the ruling party, MPLA, still. And there is a tug of war now over when there will be a meeting of the MPLA to decide on a change of leadership of it, presidency of it.
So is it safe to say that President Lourenço is basically strengthening his support base to go after the dos Santos family?
Well, it's not just the dos Santos family. This is much broader. So this is not just personalized. It is indicative of how intertwined the Angolan economy was with the family members of the dos Santos family. But it is broader than just targeting them.
How much is all of this contributing to the corruption cycle in Angola?
Well, there is clearly evidence already that a variety of different businesses are finding it easier to do business in Angola because the corruption demands have declined. I know some businesses that are doing less well because they actually profited over preferential relationships and corruption. And so the cleaning up of some of this corruption has made them less profitable. So there are winners and losers in all of this, but overall, improvement of the conditions for investing in Angola is exactly what the economy needs. Lourenço's priority is to turn around this economy and to diversify it away from over-dependence on oil. It is a very oil-dependent economy. The Angolan elite remains very addicted to oil money, and that is the big challenge that Lourenço has over the next few years before his party goes to elections again in 2022.
Alex Fiennes, head of the Africa program at the British think tank Chatham House.
And Abu, this is a story that is getting comments as we speak. On our Facebook page, we have a comment from Sultan who says, Angolan and other African leaders must do well to provide all the necessary support to the independent bodies in charge of bringing corrupt officials and citizens to book. I wish the Angolans all the best in their fight to end corruption. Thank you very much, Sultan, for that comment.
And let me give you one from Kenny Nana Apia, who sent us this comment via WhatsApp. He says, imagine the number of lives that money could empower in Angola. Why are some privileged Africans so greedy? That's the question everyone is asking there. And another one from Odeyemi Olusoji says, the question of purge or victimization should not even arise in the first place. When such a brazen crime is committed, no stone should remain unturned and no one connected should be spared. That's a very, very intelligent comment. I don't know, I quite like
Keep
it.
Keep them coming.
Anyways, let's move on now to the international story. Moscow has vowed to respond harshly to the mass expulsion of Russian diplomats. The United States has kicked out 60 Russians, while 16 EU states, including Germany and other Western allies, have followed suit with a total of more than 130 Russian diplomats. diplomat staff under orders to leave.
Now, the move is a show of solidarity with the UK after the poisoning of a former Russian spy on British soil. But the Kremlin insists there's been a rush to judgment. Terry Schulz of DW News spoke earlier with Hannes Adomait, who is a specialist in Russian and European affairs at the University of Kiel's Institute for Security Policy. And he starts by explaining what Russia means exactly by a harsh response to their recent expulsions.
Well, I don't think that the response is going to be all that harsh. I think it's that's going to be the usual tit-for-tat. So they will be expelling diplomats from the United States and from European countries, Canada and Australia. And I think this should be pretty much the end of it.
Give us an overview of where things stand right now in relations between Russia and the West, because on the face of it, it looks pretty bad. How bad is it?
Well, it is really a more tense situation than it has been for quite some time. In some ways, more tense than during the Cold War, even though at the time, at present, it's more at the rhetorical level, but nevertheless. And I think the root causes of that can be found in a fundamental shift of policy that Putin embarked upon when he was elected for the third time to the office of a president, because he took a fundamental decision to actually conduct a much more strident, aggressive, actually, policy towards the West based on nationalist foundations.
That was Hannes Adomait, a specialist in the Russian and European affairs at the University of Kiel, speaking to DW's Terry Schulz.
Now we move back to Africa and specifically to Kenya, where eight prominent columnists working for Kenya's biggest media group quit over what they said was increased meddling by the government and a loss of media freedom at its outlets. Now, this development comes a day after police punched and kicked journalists covering the attempted deportation of an opposition politician in Nairobi Airport.
The controversial Kenyan lawyer and government critic Miguna Miguna is being held at Kenya's Jomo Kenyatta International Airport after he refused to board a United Arab Emirates-bound plane to return to Canada, where he is a citizen. Miguna asserts that he is a Kenyan citizen and must be allowed to enter the country without any condition. James Shimayula reports.
Speaking to local and international journalists through a narrow opening of a heavy security door at the Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi, Kenyan controversial lawyer Miguna Miguna disclosed what the authorities in Nairobi want to do to him.
They want to remove me here by force and put me in a plane, purportedly that I am an undocumented person. They want to take me to Dubai, so I'm not going, I've refused to go. They say they now want to remove me by force. Well, they would have to kill me first.
Miguna Miguna had been deported to Canada in a government crackdown on opposition politicians who participated in the mock inauguration of opposition leader Raila Odinga on the 30th of January this year. The symbolic swearing-in ceremony was in a protest of President Uhuru Kenyatta's disputed re-election. But things changed when earlier this month a Kenyan court ordered that Miguna's Kenyan passport be restored and that he be granted entry to the country. Kenyan opposition Senator James Orengo explained.
When he left, his Kenyan passport had been taken away and perforated when he was abducted. Now, the Kenyan authorities, what they should have done was to validate that passport which they had taken away from him and allow him back into the country in accordance with the court order.
As Miguna Miguna's drama continued, Mwenda Njoka, spokesman for Kenya's Interior Ministry, said immigration documents have been sent to Miguna for him to apply for Kenyan citizenship.
The Department of Immigration sent some officers with the required documents for him to fill and they apply for Kenyan citizenship. I don't know whether he had signed or not.
However, Njoka did not say why Miguna is to apply for Kenyan citizenship when he's already a Kenyan citizen by birth. Miguna also asserts that he used a Kenyan identity card to enter the country.
I am a Kenyan. I'm not traveling with a Canadian passport.
That report was compiled by James Shimanyula.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Africa Link with me, Abubakar Jallo.
And me, Wanji Komora. Thank you for joining us live on our Facebook page, DW African. I see you, Osman, and so many others listening. Keep it here.
Thank you all for those. Coming up in this half of Africa Link, we meet a woman in Liberia who is fighting for women that are victims of rape.
I believe no woman or girl should be raped. Rape cases are things that I can almost say we live with in Liberia. It happening on a daily basis.
And we are monitoring your responses live on Facebook. Osman, you say, nice news of African countries. Thank you.
That's right. But before all of those reports, the humanitarian situation around the world is deteriorating, especially as the political will needed to solve conflict, welcome refugees and address climate change also appears to be waning. But at the same time, humanitarian agencies like the UN have come under fire following sexual assault allegations.
Now, UN peacekeepers have been accused of preying on the very people they're meant to protect, putting into question the reputation of the United Nations. Africa Link's Isaac Mugabe spoke to Paula Donovan, co-director of the Code Blue Campaign, an organization that fights sexual abuse among young girls and women. Let's take a listen.
Our first concern is that this crisis is often described by the United Nations as one that's caused by the military personnel who are contributed by various member states to take part in peacekeeping operations. In truth, most of the allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse are actually made against non-military personnel, people who work for the United Nations directly and are not soldiers who are contributed by their countries. When non-military peacekeeping personnel are accused of these crimes, they are treated as though they have simply broken the UN's rules, and they're subjected to an administrative investigation and may be fired from their jobs, although that rarely happens, but they're not referred for criminal investigation and prosecution.
And how about in cases where the military personnel are involved, like the case of the five peacekeepers from South Africa who face allegations of sexually exploiting women in the DRC? Not forgetting also French peacekeeping troops in the Central African Republic who at different instances have been accused of sexually abusing young boys.
My understanding is that the South African government, which has jurisdiction over its own soldiers wherever they're operating, is following up and is conducting the investigation and will make sure that justice is served. Now, there shouldn't be any involvement by the United Nations in that procedure other than to absolutely ensure that the South African government and any other government is fulfilling its obligation and is making sure that there's justice for the victims.
But in previous instances, we've seen the UN dragging its feet in pushing for investigations whenever sexual allegations are brought, you know, about, whether by its military personnel or even those on non-military personnel. Why is this the case?
It seems that the United Nations is most concerned about its own reputation. So it feels that it's in its best interest if allegations are simply dismissed. So they do very perfunctory fact-finding. They quickly dismiss cases claiming that there isn't enough evidence to proceed. Sometimes they sort of lazily eventually refer the cases against military back to the troop-contributing country. That's why the Code Blue campaign is insisting that member states have to create mechanisms that are completely separate and neutral and external from the United Nations organization.
And are you disappointed that an organization like the UN can be bent, you know, to save its reputation rather than fight for justice for those who've been sexually abused by whoever that is under its jurisdiction?
Absolutely. Disappointment is an understatement. We are appalled that an organization would ever put its own reputation above justice and above the ideals and principles of the world body.
Paula Donovan from the Code Blue campaign, a project that's fighting against sexual abuse among young girls and women.
And we asked on our Facebook page, when peacekeepers turn into sexual predators, is it worthwhile to allow them in Africa's hotspot? Well, we got lots of comments. William Minter says, next time, let them go with their wives or get them alternatives. They are not pieces of wood. Look at how some religious men defile children. He raises another important issue there.
Indeed. Let's go to Isaac Ehuza Godwin, writing from Liberia. He says, you need to see how the United Nations soldiers in Liberia behaved with the Liberian ladies while they were here on peacekeeping mission. Now, just as Isaac is mentioning there, we have a reporter that is related to that. Stay tuned to this program.
Africa on the move.
Today we hear the story of a courageous young Liberian woman, Marianne Michelle, a victim of family neglect and abuse, who is using entertainment and movies production as a platform to campaign against social issues of domestic nature, including rape, family neglect and abandonment, and most of all, human trafficking through marriage.
Marianne is about to launch a campaign titled Fight Against Man and Woman Figures in Our Family, and her movie Ridiculous Memorandum and True Life Story of Herself. Evelyn Kwade has been following Marianne's work and now reports.
Her journey through life has been painstaking. She suffered several forms of abuses in her family and marriage. Now 29, Marianne started her advocacy at age 15. Instead of following the tales of her life to isolate herself, she took courage against the odds of Liberia's civil war to lead an advocacy program for the protection of women and girls.
It started when I was 15, at the time Madam Ellen Johnson Sirleaf had just came to power, and I saw that many young women about my age at the time and older ones, the way they were treated. I just thought it was unfair, especially those girls who got mature during the Civil War. So I thought it wise that I need to speak out.
This helped me save my child's life.
I'm not a doctor, ma.
Oh.
What happened to your child?
Rape. Two men raped my 10-year-old child.
Rape?
As cases of rape and violence increased after the war, many Liberian women and girls saw Marianne as the person to run to.
I believe no woman or girl should be raped. Rape cases are things that I can almost say we live with in Liberia. It happening on a daily basis. Most of those cases are not being reported due to some family relationship or fear of some societal rejection. We just don't want to experience that. So I hate it. I don't want any woman to experience rape.
Lucas, can I ask you something? And I want you to be very frank with me as a friend. Do you really love Miriam?
Honestly, no.
Why can't you let this girl go? Why?
More than 12 years on, as a victim of trafficking in marriage, she is using movies to tell her story with her latest movies.
One, I married her for family reasons, and secondly, for a personal reason which I can't tell you, okay? So if it's Miriam you want to talk about, I would advise that you forget about it and you have your lunch.
One of the reasons why I have decided to go in the acting field is I just don't want to sit and be narrating story from A to Z and people are not getting that picture. So as I produce movies, then I have interactive discussions. Like you watch the movie and you be like, oh, but Marianne, why did that happen in the movie? And then I can tell you the human trafficking in marriage, because I suffered it. I got married because I wanted a family of my own. But on the other side, I didn't know that my partner just got married for different reason, which of course he proved that through his action. So in giving those kind of messages, he treated me as that kind of person. At first he wasn't sleeping with me. Family stepped in. You can't leave because you need your green card. Me losing my mind and becoming useless in life, and me staying For this green card, which one do you really prioritize?
That was Evelyn Bade with that report.
Focus Europe.
Let's take you back to Europe. Voters went to polls in Amsterdam in the past week, which was March 21st, and the issue of tourism was one causing most concern for locals. The number of people visiting the Dutch capital rose from 11 million in 2005 to 18 million last year.
And that for a local population of just 850,000. Now, to curb the worst effects for local people, the city authorities are putting into place some of the most interventionist measures to be tried so far. This report from John Lawrenson in Amsterdam.
Wheelie suitcases, the sound of Amsterdam. Tourism is omnipresent in the old heart of this city, which some Amsterdammers say is fine.
Personally, I don't mind it that much. I think the atmosphere around tourists is pretty much happy and people trying to have a good time. And I think that's positive. Better than all the long faces in Amsterdam. So, of course, people make rubbish or vomiting on the street or being nasty, but in general, no, I don't mind at all.
But oh dear, there aren't many of those left.
You have all of these cheap flights coming from like Britain and they just shuttle people over to party, and so a lot of times in the morning on your way to work you'll just see the whole city littered with trash and glass and bottles and little like druggy bags, and so trash is becoming a problem.
I live on a canal, and I think 60% of the boats are Airbnb to rent.
Figures released this month show that square foot for square foot, Amsterdam is the most expensive place to live in the world. Its inhabitants tend to be well off, albeit in a tweedy, bicycle-riding way, while a good proportion of its visitors are well off their faces. Udo Kok is deputy mayor of Amsterdam.
The tourists that come here for one night don't book a hotel room because they plan to spend the afternoon on a beer bike, spend the night in a bar, and then sleep out on the streets that 1 hour that they do intend to sleep, and spend nothing other than
on beer
and, smoke their minds off. That's not the kind of tourist that adds a lot of value to the city of Amsterdam.
Cox Municipal Council has now banned Amsterdam's rather unique beer bikes, bars with pedals, basically, that used to leave their sorry trails of pee and vomit. They've also banned new hotels and new tourist shops.
We will no longer allow new shops that cater to tourists, which is revolutionary because the old zoning policies always came down to certain categories of shops. So you can only have 3 bars in a certain street or only 1 supermarket in that neighborhood. What we've said is no, we no longer allow shops whose customers are tourists. We have closed down a few shops, but of course that has been challenged by these companies in court.
But Amsterdam is moving ahead with tough anti-tourism measures, and some wanted to go further with a total ban on Airbnb.
That report was by John Lawrenson in the Dutch capital of Amsterdam.
And we are still monitoring your comments on Facebook, and we appreciate that you joined us during this live broadcast.
And we have one final commenter from Akwa Ahmadi related to the DRC story. He says, the best antidote to predatory peacekeeping is to prevent war and conflict. That's what the UN should be doing. It appears there are contracts awarded for all sorts of supplies. Peacekeeping is now business, and the UN is guilty of promoting conflict.
Yes, indeed. And just to bring you up to speed on our top story, today, the son of Angola's ex-president José Eduardo dos Santos has been formally accused of fraud.
Thank you all for joining us on this program. It's been a pleasure having you aboard. My name is Abubakar Jallo.
And my name is Wanjiko Maura. Until next time, goodbye.